Welcome to the Holistic Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Keisha Blair, wife, mother of three, author of Holistic Wealth, and founder of the Institute on Holistic Wealth. The show will showcase various experts in the key pillars of holistic wealth. Each week, we deliver the best information on how to become holistically wealthy and live your best life. Today, we have a very special episode with Dante Stewart, and we're so glad to have him finally on the podcast. Dante Stewart is an award-winning writer, speaker, and author of Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle, named by Georgia Writers Association as Georgia Writer of the Year 2022 by the Center for American Progress as one of 22 faith leaders to watch in 2022, and by Religion News Service as one of 10 up-and-coming faith influencers. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Time, CNN, NPR, and more. Dante, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be with you and just grateful to share some time.
And so, Dante, I just want to jump into it. Like, I, you know, love the book, and I even just on even page six, it just grabbed me. Basically, the gist of, if we're oppressed, you know, how can we juggle all these things? How can we pray? How can we, you know, live in a system that's constantly oppressing us and still have that spiritual deep, you know, that deepness to our spirituality? And so even on page six of your book, I thought, wow, this is amazing, because this is highlighting spiritual self-renewal. And in my book, Holistic Wealth, that's a critical part of it, is spiritual self-renewal. And I know a lot of people are struggling with that right now, given the news and everything we're going through. Any thoughts on that in terms of your book and your writing and your story?
Yeah, I feel like in this season right now that I have myself in, it is both simultaneously the most inspiring season as well as the most insecure season. You know, so much of the inspiration that I feel right now is I feel like, you know, God has me in a season where I'm really doing the type of work that speaks to the soul of people. At one point in time, I felt like my work was to speak to the soul of the nation. And I feel like one cannot go from the introduction, the fire, to the last chapter, breath, without seeing the very legitimate ways in which, like, this is an epistle to the nation, that if those in any nation were to read it in its entirety, it would not be possible for them to leave the book the same. It would not be possible for them to leave the book and turn to their neighbor and say that the way the world harms you is okay. But I feel like in this season, so much of my writing and my book is to give people language for self-acceptance and freedom. And that is a deeply spiritual task. What greater spiritual task than to repair the soul of people? What greater spiritual task than to repair the soul of those who grieve and to give them language to think about their own lives, their own grief, their own pain, but then also to remind them to look again at the various things that they do have in life that the world has not taken from them. And so I think that, yes, even on page six, by the time we get to page six, there is that spiritual task of giving the people their body back, the soul back, in a different way than when we first met.
It's amazing the season that we're in, you know, with everything going on. And I just wanted to, you know, get your views because, you know, Queen Elizabeth passed away and there's been so much talk on social media about her legacy, Queen Elizabeth II. And as it relates to colonialism, I wanted to get your impressions of that, your views early on in this episode, because I know it's on everybody's thoughts. For many of us, you know, who grew up in the colonies and, you know, saw the effects of it, and especially when you think about the racial wealth gap and, you know, what it's done to generations of Black people. And, you know, it's emotional even just talking about it. You know, I just want to get your views on that.
I mean, it's a lot. Like, a part of me, especially as I've kind of thought about this situation, is that, like, people who have been harmed by oppression deserve to be loud and angry. You know, a critical part of loving another person is courageously listening to the things that harm them and wound them. and to create a space where their voice does not have to be silenced in order for it to like do something in the world. And then also to think about symbolism and the power of symbols as it relates to the story people tell themselves. So for many people, Queen Elizabeth represents this icon, this hero. And for many of them, this hero and icon is very much in similar ways, like this idea of Captain America or this idea of Ariel, that this person represents for them the normality and the power of whiteness, that this symbol cannot be touched. It's much like the flags of the country, that they represent power and purity, particularly for a group of people who oftentimes have not have to face the way that power and purity has destroyed other people and kept them down and effectively erased them. So we see this desire to hold on to Queen Elizabeth as a symbol in many ways of what I would deem to be white heroism, or in some sense, white power. But on the other hand, that's not the only story that must be told. One must have a historical consciousness to see that the very nation that she represents is a nation that has wrought immeasurable destruction in the world. That if we're honest, wherever that nation has gone, people have died and been destroyed. Like, we just got to keep it a book.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way you could tell British history apart from the fact that almost every continent they put their feet on, their feet ended up on the necks of those people for centuries. And it is disrespectful and harmful to tell the people who have been choked and put in a chokehold very violently and structurally and systematically and intentionally put in that chokehold, that once that person dies, they now must kiss the feet that were once on their neck. That's disrespectful. But then on the other hand, I think, but the death of a person is a solemn thing. And I think one does not have to be okay with a person or a thing to allow the people who experience that death most closely to grieve that death in their own way. But that doesn't also mean that those who have been harmed by them must praise them. That's like telling those who have been abused that they have to show up to the funeral of the abuser and say nothing about the abuse. Or that's like telling somebody who has been enslaved that they must go to the mourner's bench for their enslaver and say nothing of their enslavement. And I think this should be a time, as my friend Fred Joseph would say, this should be a time where we talk about white supremacy and racism. Yes, let's grieve death. That's a true thing we should do. And I think as a person, I would want somebody to grieve me. But also, I'm not, you know, king of a nation, of an empire, you know, that has been brutal all over the world.
Yeah.
So there's levels to this grief. But then also, I think this should renew the conversation about white supremacy and colonialism, and recover the language of colonization and the damage it has done in the world. Because I feel like as much as people are talking about Queen Elizabeth, we also need to renew the language. And I'm thinking of Amis Césaire's incredible book on colonialism. We need to be talking about white supremacy and colonialism and committing to changing what somebody represented in their life, even as they have passed on in death.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree that it should be a time for self-reflection and thinking about this. And you know, it's so funny because that argument about even reparations that came up like after the George Floyd killing, there was a lot of talk about making things right and reparations. And many people across the world, many Black folks, like we've gone through centuries of oppression and that racial wealth gap that is just hard to correct because systemic oppression, right? Systemic racism. So what do you think about reparations as a tool from an economic standpoint to correct some of these wrongs?
Oh, I'm 100% believing in reparations. Mm-hmm. I think reparations should be multifaceted because our oppression is multifaceted. But one cannot prioritize a certain type of reparations over another. So I think one of the problems in America is that people would like to say that, like, oh, well, those who were harmed through slavery are not alive. And those who did the harm are not alive as well. But I would challenge them to read Sadia Hartman to say that I too, when she quotes, I too live in a time of slavery. And what I mean by that is I live in the world created by it. Me and my family, we just visited the legacy, the Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy Museum on the legacy of lynching, particularly from enslavement to mass incarceration and the legacy of anti-Black hostility and violence and the legacy of white supremacy. But even in that, it is also the legacy of Black resilience and Black joy and Black love and a deep, profound belief we have in making something of the world, even though the world we have been given is broken pieces. And so it is much about the creative endurance and love and liberation of Black people as much as it is about the ugly communal struggle. But one thing one must realize is that when you think about like walking through that museum, there's this story of the way in which simultaneously, as the wealth of the nation is being built, so is the widening gap between how one prioritizes and centers and cherishes Black life versus the way one prioritizes, centers, and cherishes white people. And even as Black people are building the wealth of the nation, particularly in New York, particularly in the South, Black people are building the wealth of this country, white people are benefiting from that wealth, and century and hundreds of years are going by, as this both building and benefit is happening. Even when we think about Black banks, there's a really good book by Dr. Mercer Berrethuran called The Color of Money. And it's particularly on Black banks. And it starts to talk about the ways in which the Freedmen's Bureau, right during the moment of Reconstruction, where in order this economic institution was opened up for Black people to kind of rebuild their life. But at the end of the day, it was still white people who exploited Black people out of the Freedmen's Bureau, somehow benefiting white people, even in those charitable organizations that were for Black people. And we see, and unless we believe that's just a thing of the past, let's see the ways in which PPP loans work in 2020, how the majority of those PPP loans, if you were connected to this right type of institution, then you got those type of loans. But if you weren't, then you were kind of SOL. And the people who benefited most from those PPP loans were not the most marginalized communities. It were those who were Black and brown who needed the most help, but who got the least outcome. Lest we believe that that was in the past, check out Brett Favre in Mississippi. Years and years working alongside, making $140 million over his career as an NFL quarterback, scheming with the former governor of Mississippi to scheme the nation's poorest out of the money that they deserve that was there for their help. And so if one can go through all those things and look at all those things and say that economic reparations is off the table, it just shows that one is not just hostile, you know, to the conditions and the sufferings of Black people. But one, you know, there's a certain type of indifference that's worse than hostility.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was Elie Wiesel who said that the opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is indifference. And so there's something, I think Kendrick Lamar would say, your soul is in question.
Yeah.
When you're not just hostile, but you're indifferent to the suffering of others. And so I think that the country owes Black people reparations. And many of these white societies owe Black people reparations. And I also think that there is also spiritual repair, emotional repair, psychological repair, you know, that needs to happen as well, that like mental health should be free. Like there should be things where like, if we don't have access, there needs to be access given to us because we have suffered And the interesting part about it is that for hit in history's sake, Black people have never just wanted Black people to be well alone. We have wanted the wellness and the wholeness and the healing of all that we come in contact with, because we understand the kind of liberating nature and spiritual nature of interdependence, that another cannot be free if I am free, if I'm not free. And I cannot be free if those who are around me are not free, including those of the animal world, the inanimate world, the world that our feet touch. If the earth is not well, then humanity cannot be well. If humanity cannot be well, then the earth will not be well as well. And I think we deserve a multifaceted project for reparations that would allow us to rest, be ordinary, live, dream, and do everything and get everything that our ancestors would not.
Absolutely. And you're so right. And you touch on so many different things that are so critical. And in terms of holistic wealth, it just comes through all of those facets. Our whole entire holistic wealth and holistic well-being has been affected by this. And so, you know, as you're talking about health too, I read one of your essays recently on parents.com where you spoke about Roe versus Wade and you spoke about your wife. And, you know, the crisis of Black women in terms of maternal health. And I am, you know, as I said in my book, I'm a maternal near miss survivor. So when I read that essay, Dante, like I felt every word of it because I know what it is to almost die in childbirth. And it's unbelievable the crisis that we have right now with maternal health. I can't imagine what you felt like in that moment. You know, you spoke about your wife losing 1,000 milliliters of blood. You spoke about, I mean, you were very vulnerable in that essay. How was that for you? And what are your thoughts in terms of Black maternal health? It's the same thing. I mean, we're all facing the same challenges. And to me, it all stems from that oppression, it stems from the fact that there's not enough investment in the healthcare that we need. And you mentioned about, you know, Black women and Black mothers and the system not believing that intuitively they know what's best for them. We know what's 100%. Best for us, right? Exactly. 100%. So what are your thoughts on that? And how has that experience shaped you?
I mean, that was a traumatic experience for me. you know, on a real, like, I don't even know why I wrote that article. Like, legit, I look back on it and sometimes I wonder, like, if I'm gonna keep it a book with you, like, sometimes I wonder, like, dag, man, should I have been this vulnerable in this article, you know? But yeah, I'm actually glad that I wrote it.
Absolutely.
Because number one, so many people feel that way and so many Black women go through that. But secondly, so many Black women and so many people don't hear from Black men on this topic in very public ways. And so when I was working with my editor, Celeste, on this essay, I had a little bit of trepidation because I was like, yo, like, I wonder if I, as a Black man, should be writing this article and not a Black woman, you know? But then she really encouraged me, was like, yo, you are the perfect person to write this because you are a Black man.
Yeah.
And because you have gone through this experience. And I'll never forget that experience. It's just written, impressed upon my soul and my mind. Even right now, I can even play back that morning in my head. And one of the things that I walked away from is that, like, yo, I've read on so many experiences of Black women that, you know, Black women are three times more likely to die in childbirth, or oftentimes that Black women, and I have a friend who almost died because the nurses didn't believe that she was in the pain that she was in. And then the other part of it is that the fact of the matter is that, like, my wife survived because, as a military family, we have this access to healthcare. And on that day, by chance, you know, it was a Black nurse and a Black doctor who delivered our baby and who checked in on our wife. So on my wife. And I think that was one of the reasons why, you know, she really, you know, survived, is because not only did she get the care that she need for her body, but even in that moment where, like, I'll never forget the Black nurse, was like, girl, this your life.
Yeah.
And it's that moment where like, right. Yo, it's like a serious situation, but like,
yeah,
that like deeply Black kinship, and particularly the Black kinship between Black women, you know, that is soul healing, that you don't need your body well in this moment, but you also need your soul to feel like you're not alone. And as a husband, there are places in my wife's soul that I can't give that to, that there's something that's like, I think that Black women have. It's like a tetheredness. Like it's a part of Black people in general, of like this Black fictive kinship that we have.
Yeah.
But there are different ways I feel like Black men and Black women express that kinship. And we both got that like, all right, I see you, I understand you, part of us. But I think in that moment, girl, this your life. Only like a Black woman could have said that in that moment in a way that was healing to my wife's heart and her soul. And then this made me think about the larger kind of struggles of like women in general and Black women in particular when it comes to healthcare and Roe v. Wade and the rolling back of reproductive rights, which is not just simply about access to abortion. It is very much about a certain type of, number one, autonomy.
Yeah.
You know, that every human being deserves a certain autonomy, a certain type of privacy that every human being deserves. But it's also about the ways in which like every human being deserves the right proper care when they walk into a place where they're already afraid. Why would we want to harm people and beat them down when they're already crushed with fear? That is a dying or dead society emotionally and psychologically. Who doesn't just want to make life harder for people, but who wants to beat them up in the process? And I wrote that piece at doing what I do best, which is writing, putting things into words, trying to wrestle with, you know, what does it mean to think about Roe v. Wade, reproductive rights, particularly as a Christian,
yeah,
and a Black man, because I felt like, I don't think I've read an essay where a Black male Christian has written on Roe v. Wade before.
Yeah.
I don't think I've read that before. Nor do I feel like I've read essays. Now, I just don't think I've read essays that personalize that story and connects both the religious dimensions and the political dimensions. And I'm just glad and thankful that like God gave me the courage and the mind to write that piece alongside all the wonderful writings, you know, that were done. Because really that came out of me listening to my friend Tanya Mosley. She did a episode entitled Womb, where it's Black women talking about Roe v. Wade and reproductive rights. And it's out of that essay that kind of gave me the courage and even the framework to think about like what I wanted to say in that piece.
And you mentioned that there's not a lot of Black pastors talking about this, writing about this.
Mm-hmm.
From a spiritual perspective, how did you wrestle with that? I mean, that experience is a defining moment for you as it was for me. I know for me, that's what, you know, put this thing into perspective for me as a Christian. For you as a Christian minister, how did it shape your views around this? And in terms of spirituality, because I know, you know, there's so much talk about this now. How do we frame this going forward in terms of how we think about, as you mentioned, an individual's right to privacy, autonomy, and that access to care that they need?
I mean, first and foremost, I mean, I have to look at Jesus. You know, there are many ways that many people, you know, look at Jesus, and as the great mystic Howard Thurman say, there are varied interpretations of the life of Jesus. But I think one of the critical questions that he asked, that Thurman asked, is like, what does the message of Christianity have to say to those who have their back against the walls, who live constantly in a place in which life is not just made hard, but breathing is made hard as well. And so, like, I think in my book and even in my own life and in my own faith story, I feel like the older I get, the more I realize that my faith cannot be a weapon, you know, but it must be a world to be explored. The Bible can't be a tool that I use for power and control, but it must be a way of conversing with the stories of old, you know, trying to interpret and live out the ways that I can live a life that's connected to God, but also connected to others. You know, that there are so many different images of God in the Bible and ways in which like people converse with the divine in the Bible. And for me, I know what it's like to believe in a God that hates other people, to believe in a faith that, you know, doesn't trust people who are different than you, who believe in a faith that must be simply about boundaries and policing those boundaries. And the older I get, the more I realize that I can't scream that I love other people, be so loud about God and so silent and quiet about what's going on in the world. Well, that means that I had to go through a process of unlearning some things. So one of the most spiritually loving things that we can do is unlearn the toxic ways that we have come to our faith and the toxic and harmful ways that our faith have touched others. When we see the life of Jesus, we see many and varied stories of Jesus touching and being touched by other people, pronouncing upon them that even though the state and the church or the state and the religious space rejects you, I do not reject you. Even though they want to find fault in you, I don't find fault in you. Your faith has made you well. Go and be well. Go and do your thing. Go and be free. Go and sin no more. Daughter, your faith has made you well. And I think there's something about when people come in contact with us, can they first be addressed in a way that's affirmative? Like when I think about that story of daughter, your faith has made you well, you hear about all the ways others thought about her. But when she came to Jesus, there is an affirmation. Now, daughter, you are somebody who was cherished, who was loved, who was prioritized. Your faith has made you well. It wasn't me.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when we read Jesus' story, oftentimes we think that Jesus is oftentimes the conduit of other people's healing when Jesus wants to affirm that you are the conduit of your own healing. You just needed me to affirm something in you that was already there. And so I think so much of faith right now, if it can do that, if it can read our sacred texts in the most healthy and healing and liberating ways as possible, and if people can come in contact with us in ways that are affirmative rather than performative or domineering or dominating, then I think that whatever we desire of our faith in the world, and I believe so many of us desire that faith be a thing that makes us come alive and be a thing that can be helpful. If we do that, then I think we will see this faith and the world be a much better place. But there are some things that we have to unlearn, that we have to reinvent, that we have to get rid of in hopes that, like our great teacher, our great savior, if we are indeed Christian and we take that identity, not as a totalizing identity, but a meaningful identity, then we should live in that way that, like, in the final story of Jesus, what people remember is his love and not his power.
So Dante, on page 35 of your book, you spoke about Black exceptionalism. And you spoke even before that, prior to that, you know, you spoke about having to straddle two worlds and your experience, which is the experience of many Black people, whether it's at work, you know, in the community. You spoke about growing up having to straddle these two worlds and feeling like, you know, you had to do this to sort of fit in. And there's that quote by W.E.B. Du Bois on page 35 that just spoke to me. And that culture of Black exceptionalism where, you know, many people feel that they have to do this to fit in at the workplace, or they found success because they fit a white ideal, or they found success of having to fulfill some kind of ideal. And I know you can, you know, explain it more because, you know, that part of the book I found especially powerful. But I just like you to expand on that because I feel like many people can relate to this. Many Black people can relate to this in a special way when you talk about finding our identity, finding our place in the world, and having to struggle to do that in a culture and a society and economy dominated by one race. So I don't know if you could expand on that.
Yeah. So that quote is from The Souls of Black Folk, which is a very famous quote where he shares that one ever feels the two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body. And I think that's one of the challenging things when you live in a, when you're dominated in a society by oppression, is that oftentimes, you know, you have, in order for you to have access and to have power inside society, you have to be in proximity to those who hate you most and who make, render you most invisible. And then I think the question that most hits me is that, like, he wonders, like, how does it feel to be a problem? And I think that is the question that is so hard for so many, is that, like, and this is one of the reasons why assimilation happens, is those who are on the margins oftentimes answer that question through escape and erasure. That if I can erase my Black identity and just become Christian, then finally these people will see me as human. That if I can erase my sexual identity and become just whatever, then finally they'll see me as human. If I can erase this or escape into this place, then it'll finally be all over. And I think that is one of the challenging things that we face, is that, like, we render ourselves not beautiful because we do whatever we can to move in a world that's brutal. Like, and oftentimes that means giving up what we know most, and that's our own dignity, our own humanity, simply to be free. And how can we blame those who have had to crawl out of the mud and create a life out of nothing? How can we blame them for trying to escape in better places and better lands, quote unquote, just so that their soul can be free? And sadly, the fact of the matter is that, like, escape and erasure is not freedom. It is dehumanization. And what we need is to live in a world where escape and erasure is not even a possibility, but that being human and free is the norm over everything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And those are powerful words. And I'm wondering, Dante, we spoke about Queen Elizabeth II earlier, and kind of this, I remember seeing on Twitter somewhere, somebody put, like, it's almost like a, you know, not necessarily starting to love your oppressors, but you have this kind of idolization of that type of, because you've been so oppressed for so long, and you've been taught and brainwashed. And I think there was a part in your book too, where it started from, where you mentioned it started from the plantation, this brainwashing. Black people started to aspire to an ideal that was created structurally, systemically, and almost taught to hate themselves, hate anything Black. You know, it's so complex and it's so multifaceted. But I'm wondering, for those people who are trying to navigate those spaces, like, what do you say?
I think the first word that must always be shared is that you are enough, and that your life is enough. Like, I don't think we hear this enough, is that, like, you actually really don't need what they have. You are loved because you are you. And I'm willing to say that to you until you actually believe it. I'm willing to be with you through all your struggles, through all your journey. That at the end of the day, when you have come to a place where, like, the well has run dry, you would have heard me at the beginning, you would have heard me throughout, and you would have heard me at the end, that you are enough. And that you don't have to distance yourself from who you are to feel loved and accepted. Now, from a practical note, you need to learn as much as you can about the places you come from and the people you come from. That means that some of us have to go on a sojourn almost to find ourselves. Go to museums, read all the books you can. Watch all the documentaries, because it would be a shame that, like, we would die one day without ever having lived life knowing who we were. And I think so many of us don't hear that, is that like, yo, you are enough, but there is also so much more for you to know. And so that's the worry that I would share.
Absolutely. And so well said, Dante. That was amazing. And so where can people find the book if they want to get their hands on a copy? And where can they reach you on social media and your website?
Yeah, they can find a book wherever books are sold. You know, as my friend Jason says, we don't support each other just by our words. We support one another by our dollars. So make sure you get a hard copy. Of course, like, you know, audio and Kindle is great. But, you know, the hard copies, you know, go a long way. So, you know, if it's not at your bookstore, at your local independent bookstore, you know, request it. If it's not at your library, request it there. Yeah. If you don't do that, get it from Amazon, you know, get it, you know, whatever way you deem necessary to get this book. My biggest thing is I want people to encounter this story because I believe so much in my writing. You know, I believe so much in the story that in some sense, frankly, I believe that everybody can get something from the book, from the things I'm trying to write, you know, because I go into everything that I write, as Alice Walker said in at the beginning of The Color Purple. She said that this wouldn't have happened without the divine. And I believe that as well, that when I go into write, even sometimes when I'm most deeply insecure, I am deeply dependent on the spirit's help, but also deeply thinking about what others are going through and how to speak to their soul and give them language for their own healing, their own grieving, and their own joy. So definitely get it wherever books are sold. You can find me at Stuart Dante C on all my social medias or DanteCStuart.com. You know, where I'm going through, like, you know, some reconstruction on the website to keep everything up to date. But that's the way people can reach me.
And you're so right. We need to support each other. We need to support these books that matter, and we need to support with our dollars as much as we support with our hearts and our minds and our soul. So Dante, it was so amazing having you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, 100. It's been incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us this week on Holistic Wealth with Keisha Blair. Make sure to visit our website, KeishaBlair.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, or via RSS so you will never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes, or if you simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Are you a member of the Institute on Holistic Wealth? If not, what are you waiting for? Go to InstituteOnHolisticWealth/memberships to choose your membership plan and join. As a member, you get so many perks. Free worksheets, advice, coaching, and a member's workshop to design an intentionally designed life. You need to figure out your life purpose? Take the Build Your Life Purpose Portfolio online self-paced course. You're struggling with all your money decisions? Take the free financial identities quiz and then take the course. You recently had a breakup, job loss, or experienced the death of a loved one? Take the holistic healing course. You need an overall plan to achieve holistic wealth? We will help you figure out your holistic wealth blueprint. And of course, if you want to start making money by helping others achieve holistic wealth, become a certified holistic wealth consultant. Regardless of what career you've got, the Institute will show you how to increase your income and walk in your purpose. The sooner you join, the sooner you start to achieve a more holistically wealthy lifestyle. And you're going to want to stay for a very long time. So go to InstituteOnHolisticWealth/memberships to join. If you haven't read the book yet, pick up a copy of the award-winning, best-selling Holistic Wealth 32 Life Lessons to help you find purpose, prosperity, and happiness.